It's huge. Local Palestinians see this as an aggressive statement by a group of settlers who are determined to remove Palestinians from their homes and their land.
Their fury is tangible. The people of Silwan lined the streets, denouncing the settlers' call to demolish Palestinian homes. For them, this small march is part of a bigger scheme by the Israelis to change the character of East Jerusalem for good. The Israeli Prime Minister tried to ban the march, but without success. He didn't want another embarrassing incident when a senior American official was in town.
I met with Senator Mitchell again this morning. Israel wants to start the peace process immediately. The United States also wants to start immediately, and I can only hope that the Palestinians will also want to start the peace process immediately. We will know in the next few days if the process will be resumed, which I hope it will. The talks with the United States and its representative were very positive.
On the streets of East Jerusalem, it's difficult to see any justification for his optimism. Palestinians hear the Israeli government talking about peace, but its actions on the ground send a very different message. Jackie Rowland, Al Jazeera, occupied East Jerusalem.
Well, in Lebanon, around 2,000 protesters have marched through the capital, Beirut, to promote secularism. The demonstrators are calling for a separation of religion from politics in a country home to 18 different religious sects. Well, the most popular complaint is from interfaith couples that are unable to marry due to the strict laws. MK Mulu reports.
Tony is in love with Fatima, yet they can't tie the knot in Lebanon.
This problem is common in any society where religions and sects coexist. Unfortunately, the girl's family doesn't approve, saying he's not one of us, not one of our religion.
It's an opinion mirrored in almost all aspects of life. Without a civil code in Lebanon, your faith follows you from the cradle to the grave. Births, marriages, deaths are all handled by religious bodies. Interfaith couples are simply left with little choice but to tie the knot abroad.
Why should I go abroad to get married to the girl I love, then come back to live in my country?
And it's this frustration that sparked these protests. Young Lebanese united in their demands, calling for a separation of religion and state and legal recognition for consensual civil marriage.
We bank on the Lebanese citizens' secularism and their right to have a civil family law.
Their calls have also controversially been backed by senior Muslim and Christian politicians.
Citizenship is a straight bond between the state and its citizens. This bond cannot be governed by religions or sects. It transcends above them all.
Why call only for ending political sectarianism? Let's bring sectarianism in all its forms to an end.
Popular opinion may also be shifting in favor of less religion in politics, but marriage between people of a different religion is still a contentious issue. Nearly half of the population is against it. MK Umolu, Al Jazeera.
The World Health Organization is marking World Malaria Day, warning half the Earth's population is at risk from the deadly disease. Well, medical breakthroughs are being made and a vaccine is being trialed. But in countries like Kenya, the main fight is to spread greater awareness of malaria and how to avoid infection. Al Jazeera's Catherine Soy reports from Siaa in western Kenya.
April marks one of the peaks of Kenya's malaria season, with Siaya district in the west currently the worst hit. 90% of patients admitted in the public referral hospital here show signs of malaria. Children are the most vulnerable. This is the equivalent of a high dependency unit where the most critically ill children go. Monica Odhiambo brought in her son who suffered a bout of malaria a week ago.
Where I come from, malaria is very common. Many children have died. Some, like mine, are brought to the hospital and survive, but others cannot be saved.
Monica's son is one beneficiary of a vaccination research program being carried out in poor rural communities in 11 sub-Saharan African countries. The program that aims to halt malaria infection is in its third and final phase. Optimism is high that the vaccine could be readily available on shelves by 2015.
Phase 2 trials were done elsewhere, they were not done here. and they found that it is effective, but it was in small groups of children. They found that it reduces malaria by 40%, severe malaria by 40%, and overall malaria by 50%. So children still got malaria, but it wasn't that frequent any longer. So that is a big achievement.
In this health center out in the countryside, Roselina Tieno brings her three-month-old twins. She has just enrolled in the vaccination program. Being a single mother with no job, she could not be happier. Her story resonates with many others in this region. Having watched her father and aunt die from malaria, she says she wants her children protected from the disease. 900 children below the age of one have so far been enrolled in the program, but children continue to die. A third of deaths of children under 5 here in Siaya are because of malaria. One of the biggest challenges facing those few rural health centers that people can actually access is that the required malaria medicine is more often than not unavailable.
Malaria becomes a major problem because when people don't access treatment in good time, then they end up with complications, and these complications are what lead to death. So one of the major issues we've had is with the supply of drugs to the health facilities.
Despite current control efforts, malaria still kills at least 1 million people globally every year, most of them children under 5 years. Kenya alone accounts for 36,000 child deaths annually, a figure that stakeholders hope to reduce by half by 2015. This, by all means, a tall order. Catherine Soy, Al Jazeera, Siaya, Western Kenya.
British politicians are preparing for their final full week of campaigning before a general election next Thursday. One of the core issues is whether to change the actual electoral system.
Yes, the Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg says it's one of the first things he'll be addressing in the event of a hung parliament. He says the current system of first past the post doesn't give fair representation. Alan Fisher explains.
Before a vote's been counted, this election is being dominated by what happens the day after. The surge in opinion polls for the Liberal Democrats has exposed real issues with Britain's first-past-the-post system. It's what every party is now talking about.
I think after this election, the one thing that's going to be absolutely clear as we come out of this election is there'll be a very strong focus on our electoral system.
I want to give everybody a say in our democracy, and you can only do that if you change the electoral system.
I support our electoral system. I think it is a decisive way of changing government. I've always backed it.
If we look at the latest opinion poll, the Conservatives are in the lead with 34%, the ruling Labour Party has dipped into third place with 28%, and the Liberal Democrats have moved into second on 29%. That would suggest all three parties would have roughly the same representation in the new Parliament. Well, not under the current UK system. Translating these into seats, the Conservatives in blue would take 264, well short of a majority. Labour in red would actually be the biggest party on 267. And the gold of the Liberal Democrats would fill just 90 places in the UK House of Commons. A hung parliament, which would mean a coalition government.
Britain is not a country that has had many coalition governments, and they've tended not to be popular. The political parties themselves, both Labour and the Conservative, have very much got a majoritarian mindset. They don't like the idea of having to share power.
It boils down really to where the votes are won. Britain's electoral map looks like this. Labour win more in the cities, sometimes by narrow margins, so picking up more seats per vote. The Conservatives bank huge majorities in rural areas. The Liberal Democrats have won a few seats, finished second in a lot more, giving a wider spread of support, but still they end up with just a handful of MPs. Anyone wishing to form the new UK government will almost certainly, on these figures, have to rely on the support of the Liberal Democrats. They insist there must be a change in the way the country votes. The first-past-the-post system may throw up an odd result on May the 6th, but could be the last time it's used in Britain. Alan Fisher, Al Jazeera, London.
Well, of course, that election coming up now in about a week. We've got lots more on that on our website. The address, of course, aljazeera.net/English. Lots of blogs as well from Alan Fisher and all the other correspondents that are following the election. You can find that on the blogs. Well, it had shown reluctance to help contribute to an economic rescue plan for Greece, but now Germany has announced it is willing to support the country. On Friday, Greece asked for the activation of a $50 billion bailout from the EU and the IMF.
But despite the latest announcement, Germany says certain conditions must be fulfilled before any aid is given. Jonah Hull reports.
Even as talks continue over a giant financial rescue package for Greece, port workers in the capital Athens are on strike. They're demonstrating against government reforms in the cruise shipping industry, part of austerity measures aimed at curbing a disastrous deficit. Belt tightening is never popular policy, but there'll need to be a lot more of it in return for the financial help Greece is looking for from, among others, Germany.
Deutschland wird helfen, wenn die entsprechenden Voraussetzungen.
Germany will help if the preconditions have been met. This will take a few more days and needs to be discussed with calm consideration, with proper deliberation and with decisiveness, because it's only if this program is effective in the long term that we will have a chance of securing the permanent stability of the euro.
Germany would be the biggest single European contributor to a proposed $50 billion Eurozone and International Monetary Fund rescue package. But while Germany and others agonize over using taxpayer money to compensate financial mismanagement in Greece, Athens badly needs help. Greece faces the next tranche of loan repayments on May the 19th, and there are growing fears it may default. The country's finance minister struck a rallying note. This is not a country of international cheats, he said, nor a country that wants to live in debt at the expense of the European taxpayer. Greece, he said, is a country that can stand on its feet, but first the Greek people must believe that there is a solution. As Greece seeks that solution, borrowing costs are soaring. On Monday, the interest rate charged to Greece for borrowing on international markets was close to 10%. That's three times what safer bet Germany pays, for instance, and a clear sign of further dwindling confidence. Jonah Hull, Al Jazeera.
Let's go to Egypt now, where the rising cost of meat has left consumers and businesses alike with a bitter taste in their mouths. A 25% hike in prices in the past month alone means many can no longer afford to feed their families.
Well, on Monday, more than 1,000 restaurants across the country staged a protest as Amal Khaki reports red meat was taken off the menu.
Ahmed Garada has been a butcher for 40 years in this middle-class neighborhood in Cairo. Boycott or no boycott, he says he'll stay open. He needs the business. Today, he sells a kilogram of beef for the equivalent of $10. A 25% hike from last month. The soaring prices have chopped into his profits, losing him 30% of his customers. Greed is the main reason for higher prices, he says, calling on the government to intervene.
The government has to monitor the process, beginning with raising livestock on to fodder prices, all the way down to retailers. Otherwise, they have to import more meat to increase supply. If they do that, prices will go down and business will boom again.
But some of Ahmed's remaining customers are still prepared to buy meat despite the boycott.
I wanted to cook chicken today. My children told me they are fed up and want meat. We have to cater for their needs, and it's difficult to depend on poultry and fish alone for protein, and the taste of imported meat is not good.
Many Egyptians insist local meat is the best. For them, it's a matter of taste, and they simply don't trust imported, refrigerated, or frozen meat. But these price hikes mean they have cut back on their consumption. It's no longer part of their daily diet. Meat is now a treat.
Wagdi Al-Kirdani heads the organization that called more than 1,300 restaurants around the country to refrain from serving meat dishes on Monday. He says the boycott took 500 tons of meat off restaurant tables.
It's about time to stop this increase of the unacceptable rates of the all kind of meat. And the restaurants always use the good cuts of the meat, veal and mutton, which is very expensive now.
We tested the boycott on two riverboat restaurants that refused to let us film officially. No meat on the menu at one. But at another, which claimed to be part of the boycott, the ribeye steak was still being served for customers who can afford it. Though the red meat boycott was largely limited to restaurants, and just for one day, its organizers have claimed it a success. But for ordinary Egyptians, many of whom are poor, the crunch of soaring food prices in general, and meat in particular, means feeding their families is becoming even more challenging. Amr Al-Kahki, Al Jazeera, Cairo.
An unmanned submarine is being
meet on the menu at 1, but the number which claimed to be part of the boycott, the ribeye steak was still being served for customers.
And welcome to Bathrobs Pier's Broadsides. Having a little confusion here in the studio, but hey, stay tuned for 2 hours of civil rights chatter about local issues here in Santa Cruz. The main discussion is around the issue of settling a lawsuit against the City Council by ending the sleeping ban, or at least that's what I'm proposing to the City Council. Stay tuned.
Raises the question, who owns the land? The homeless are a problem for only one reason. Our president raises the question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land? Could it be 90 million dead Indians? Who owns the land?
Connect.
And there it is, another version, or I should say another repetition of that old favorite, or perhaps getting a little tiring to some, but yeah, still got a certain beat to it. Land by Five. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Robert, and you are tuned to 101.1 FM. It's also freakradio.org on the Internet. And the call-in numbers here are 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz, and 469-3119. Again, the 427-3772 is the more frequent number called, but if you got it and you want to call it, hey, call it in and we'll talk. My preferred subjects have to do with local stuff, though I sometimes wander about in the national and international field as I become despairing, angry, or sarcastic, depending on my mood. And you can, too. Or you can be optimistic, joyful, and inject some light into the otherwise murky proceedings. Tip of the hat to folks helping me today to get this show together. I'm, for some reason, more exhausted than usual. We tried to do a little petitioning today in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz, and it didn't quite come off. We're planning to come back tomorrow, and the issue is going to be the one that I mentioned earlier in the show, which has to do with the settlement offer that I've made to the Santa Cruz City Council so that it can stop spending taxpayer money on the lawsuit, which they are defending endlessly and agonizingly throughout the last 9 years to protect the faces and the butts of three mayors who overstepped their boundaries and falsely arrested me. Actually, two of the mayors made the formal arrest. The third initiated the arrest with a procedure by demanding that, essentially insisting I'd violated the rules and giving impetus to what was an unconstitutional and abusive, I think also illegal action, illegal under the State Brown Act, unconstitutional under the First Amendment, of having me evicted from city council, being told to leave, and then arrested when I did not leave after I made a brief, fleeting gesture of dissent to a bit of city council chicanery and arrogance. I would even say sort of a little example of petty tyranny that you so often see at the Santa Cruz City Council if you are watching it with any persistence. That was when I made a mock Nazi salute because the mayor at that time threatened a peace activist with arrest if she didn't leave the microphone before she had her chance to speak, after she'd waited throughout an entire oral communications period and had been promised the opportunity to speak. It was a new low in Mayor Crone's activity and set the bar so far below that it eventually became the standard where he had, instead of giving people more oral communications time, the time people are allowed to permit to speak on any subject that they wish, which because of the council's very selective process in putting things on their agenda, often covers the most important subjects that are in the community because they're those that are not addressed in the city council itself on the agenda. At that period of time, which has traditionally been 3 minutes, Crone reduced it to 2 minutes, and Matthews, whom I dubbed 2-Minute Matthews, and Coonerty, particularly, our current mayor, has made that his standard of cutting public comment far back, as well as adopting other measures that I wish to see changed. And I'm trying to do that through the pressure of this lawsuit, which is not specifically about those council changes. It's more about a large chunk of change that they owe the attorneys, and a money that they owe me for a false arrest. And because they are, I think, anxious about going to trial on this issue, they are instead appealing the whole business to the Supreme Court. The trial, of course, would be the trial not of me, but of the three mayors who adopted the repressive actions that they shouldn't have done. And at least in terms of the very specific processes they used, haven't done since, although they've used other tactics and techniques to deal with critics like myself without allowing me the same amount of time that other people are provided, and in fact penalizing everyone else in an attempt to cut back the comments of people like myself to the city council. And this is something that will come out, hopefully, at the trial, which doesn't have to happen if the city council wants to settle. And the settlement I've talked about already on the air, and I'm going to talk about it again. But before we get into that, because we've talked about it before, it bears continuing discussion because it's really kind of on the menu at the moment. Even though Mayor Coonerty is rigorously denying he's going to do anything about this, it's still something that the community does have a say in and can weigh in on. And that's the whole point of this tabling in front of the bookshop, Coonerty, or Santa Cruz, as they call themselves. I call it Coonerty because it's owned by the Coonerty family and is the favored lair of Ryan Coonerty, or at least one of the spots. One of the few spots I've actually seen him at in the last year or two. That and city council. The issue is, how does the public feel about this? And I ask all of you out there who are listening, if you want to call in and talk about this issue, how do you feel about this issue? I'm proposing to take zero money from the city council and the citizens of Santa Cruz for myself if the city council agrees to stop wasting its money on the sleeping ban law, the Municipal Code 6.36010A that criminalizes homeless people at night in a city that has shelter, zero walk-in shelter for people who need emergency shelter on that night, but only space for about 48 people in the Paul Lee Loft. And you'll also hear, if you want to closely examine the court records of the most recent Peace Camp 2010 trial, that there are a few beds in the River Street shelter and maybe a few beds in some of the programs which involve being clean and sober and involve being on waiting lists. But on any particular night from April 15th to November 15th when the armory is closed, there's no walk-in shelter anymore. There used to be, you could get into a church group if you were really, really lucky and really, really disabled and really, really old or really, really female. Women have more chance than men do in this situation. There are fewer women who are homeless than there are men, and that for one reason and for another. They're favored because they're weaker and in terms of their physical build often. But that isn't the case anymore. There is no walk-in shelter in Santa Cruz, although we were told in this kind of cooked-up testimony at the Peace Camp 2010 trial of six people for so-called lodging who were using a necessity defense, saying we had no place to go, so we had to sleep where we were. Not to mention we had the right to protest, and we fell asleep protesting on occasion, but that was a necessary part of the protest, and not to mention a necessary part of survival behavior for homeless people at night. But what the testimony presented by the prosecution was that on the nights that there was protesting, there turned out to be two beds. There were emergency beds open in the River Street shelter that no one knew about, that were not advertised, and that were normally reserved for mentally ill people, or people who are diagnosed with mental illnesses. Although it's not entirely clear whether it was mental illnesses or just open beds, but not any beds that had ever been mentioned to us by Monica Martinez, the head of the Homeless Service Center, anywhere else. But the fact that there were vacancies in these two beds for 40 or 50 or 60 homeless people who were sleeping in the safe zone established by Ed Fry and other activists from Huff in front of the county building, and in a protest led by Christopher Doyen and others who had actually found and established a safe zone and a zone where people could use a bathroom facility, which was really the only legal place for people to sleep. It wasn't actually a legal place. They had made it illegal, but for the last month it had been tolerated by the county authorities. They hadn't complained. And, of course, it had been a matter of also First Amendment rights because the reason they were sleeping there was in part to bring to the county and city and the community the reality that it's illegal to sleep anywhere and everywhere in the city limits of Santa Cruz on any public property whatsoever. There's no somewhere to sleep for homeless people in Santa Cruz, a point which I have repeated endlessly and will probably continue to repeat. Bears repetition anyway. Anyway, so that's going to be one of the topics that I'm going to be talking about, and I've already spent about 10 or 15 minutes on it. But before I leave that topic, or I should say I'm going to leave that topic and come back to it and give a kind of discussion of what happened, well, what my latest kind of what are the latest updates are on that. And there's not a lot terribly new and exciting, although there are a couple things which are kind of encouraging. Here's some interviews from the street.
Quick interview. So I'm here at the aftermath of the Monday meal at the Calvary Episcopal Church. It's, do we know what time it is? No, we don't have anybody who has a watch.
It's about 6:37-ish?
Something like that. It's the sun is dropping lower in the sky, and my watch is here, and it is about 7:10. We're talking with
Jacob Dawson.
Today, of course, it's Monday the 9th of May. And Jacob, you have a pooch with you. What kind of a dog is that?
A blue heeler and Australian shepherd.
And the name of this dog?
Miss Piggy Cowpie.
And Miss Piggy Cowpie met the law the other day.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I stopped to use the restroom in front of the metro and left my buddy with the dog and came out of the restroom, grabbed the leash, and immediately a cop car zoomed in.
Where were you when the police officer arrived in this vigilant...
Right in front of the metro on Pacific Avenue.
So you were off the metro property but on the sidewalk?
Yes.
And what did this officer say?
He just walked up and immediately ticketed us and asked my buddy if he had service tags. And then he said yes, and then he said his service tags are useless.
Name of the cop?
Officer Winston and Officer Forbus. I don't know which.
My favorite, too. That's Dan Forbus. David, if it's the one who's usually with Officer Winston, did he have any other commentary as he gave you this $200 to $300 or $500 or $400 ticket?
He said I should have thought about this before I attacked one of his officers.
Have you been in the practice of attacking officers?
No.
Who was he? What was he referring to? Do you have any idea?
Public intoxication and resisting arrest that I got a week or two prior.
So this was a payback.
Yes.
Your dog must pay the penalty for your drinking habits.
Exactly.
Do you recall this prior incident?
Yes. It was a celebratory drink, and it just ended bad.
And were you, in fact, engaging in roughhousing with the officers?
When he slammed my face in the ground, yes. I was,
who he being?
Officer Clark.
And what were the circumstances in which he, should we say, introduced your face to the sidewalk?
Accusations saying I hit somebody, but they grabbed me when I was asleep and I woke up. Well, I did hit somebody, but I was asleep during the matter.
So, understanding that this is going to be played publicly, do you want to make any statements about this? Are you going to court still for this case?
Yes, I'm going to court on the 1st because I was sleeping at Taco Bell and someone grabbed my arm and I woke up swinging and turned out to be a hospitality woman.
And what time of day or night was it?
This is late afternoon.
And... So you think you inadvertently hit the hospitality woman?
Yes, because I'm out here on the streets. I have to worry about troll bashers and people beating up homeless and stabbing people in their sleeping bags. And I have to be alert, and anytime I get touched when I'm sleeping, I tend to retaliate.
Where exactly were you when you were sleeping?
Around Taco Bell.
And what did she say to you when she woke you?
She did not say a thing. She just grabbed my elbow and pulled me up.
I see. So... it wasn't a matter of a, sir, wake up sort of thing.
No, it was not. It was just somebody pulling my arm, and I retaliated.
And then what happened?
I apparently hit her in the chest and then left, and then went to the metro where a security guard, not even an officer, tried to grab me, and I pushed him out of the way because he shouldn't be trying to grab me. And then that's when police officer stepped in.
And then you were taken to the ground?
Yes.
Okay, so your preferred recreational drug or anxiety-relieving...
medicine.
Is...
medical marijuana.
But this time you were under the influence of...
whiskey in the incident before.
And you're facing a misdemeanor charge of assault on a...
battery and resisting arrest.
I see. And how long were you held in jail?
7 hours, drunk tank.
And you have a court date for?
For June 1st.
And what court, do you know?
Santa Cruz County Court.
At what time?
8:15?
Something like that? Okay, probably arraignment.
Yeah.
Wow, and your name on the court calendar will be what?
Jacob.
Last name?
Dawson.
And how do we know you on the street so we can tell all our police friends? If you wish to give that information.
Dreadlocks and a Ren and Stimpy shirt and some brown overalls. And a very cute dog.
Indeed. How is Santa Cruz treating you other than the police and the hosts and the security guards at the Metro?
It's almost the only interactions I have on the daily. They're everywhere, trying to bust everybody for everything.
What's happened to you today, Monday the 9th of May?
Told not to sit down countless places. Always got to be on the lookout when I'm smoking a cigarette or medicating because I don't exactly have a house. And legally I need a house to medicate even though I have my medical marijuana card. But it's kind of hard for a homeless person to medicate without a house. So it's catch 22.
You know, it's illegal to be without a house. Why don't you just get a house, man? I mean, it's simple as that.
Right.
Anything else happening around town that you think we should know about?
Not really. Surf, I heard, is pretty good lately.
You are a surfer?
No, I'm not. Friends are.
Now, when you sleep at night, have you been getting camping tickets?
No. Too smart for that.
And because you keep a low profile at night?
Yes, I've been doing this for almost 13 years.
In Santa Cruz?
On and off. In Santa Cruz for about 11.
Have you noticed any change in how the laws are enforced around camping in the last decade?
Yes and no. It's always been, I mean, it's been tolerated in the past, but still illegal, technically, but lately it's just been zero tolerance, unless you just get, like, a nice younger officer that, like, hasn't started hitting the meth pipe yet.
So you think that officers are, should we say, tanking up?
Yes.
And why do you say that?
There's evidence. You see it in some officers' eyes when they're up late at night and they're sweating and they're writing you a ticket for smoking a cigarette or sitting on a planter box at 3 a.m. when you just want to have a conversation or a slice of pizza.
And have you had that experience yourself?
Yep.
Last time was when?
I mean, this specific time was actually about a year ago, but I mean, I've also known people who have claimed to use with officers.
Really?
Not specifying any names.
Certainly not. We wouldn't want to impugn the reputations of any homeless people by associating them with certain officers.
Right. But it is a good drug of choice for officers because it's out of your system in only 3 days.
Interesting. Well, there's a proposal that's being launched to... You may have heard of the Nazi salute lawsuit. Have you heard about that?
No.
Well, there's this guy in town who, when the council tried to evict someone from the city council, gave the Nazi salute without saying anything. He just indicating you're a bunch of fascists. They arrested him, put him in jail, and then they didn't charge him because it was actually free speech. He wasn't hurting anybody. He wasn't disrupting anything. He just made a gesture of dissent. He sued the city council. That's going to trial, and now that's going to the Supreme Court, and he's floating a proposal to drop, because now it's hundreds of thousands of dollars of costs right now, to drop that in favor of ending the sleeping ban. If the city agrees to end the sleeping ban, he'll drop the lawsuit. What's your thoughts on that?
If you lose the sleeping ban, it's good and bad. I mean, people would also flock to the town, and it would be a cool town for the hippie community and travelers. But I don't know. I mean, there'd be a lot of people. There already is a lot of people, and when they all come out of the woods and can legally sleep, people would be surprised how many people that look like their own sons, daughters, grandson, granddaughters, brothers and sisters that are out here that nobody really knows about. They just scoff and turn their noses up and say, get a job, bum. But I have to go.
We've been talking with...
Jacob.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thanks.
We're talking with...
And before we move on to that next interview, and that interview you just heard was 3 days ago, Monday, at the regular meal at the Red Calvary Episcopal Church, Father Joel Miller, Rene Curry, others are involved in that. You can check it out from 5 to 7. There's some voluntary Bible stuff, which you don't have to sit through if you don't want to. You can have the meal, although I understand the food is getting more sparse than it was, or at least that was the case a couple weeks ago. Also at that red church is a homeless legal assistance project. In case you have tickets, I believe Steve Plaich, who's been active in a number of fields, including suicide prevention and needle exchange, is there offering his legal assistance. He's not a certified member of the bar, as far as I know, or I may have that wrong. He's been to law school. He's worked with law firms for decades, according to his report. But he's not a practicing attorney, so you should be advised of that. He simply will give you the benefit of his own research and his own opinion, but you should, you know, come to your own conclusion. But he will be available there, or has said he will be, and has been for the last few weeks. That's Steve Plaich. You can also reach him at 334-8692, 334-8692. And he's quite accessible. In fact, I'm going to try to reach him before the show is over to see if he has any updates on anything he's been pursuing. He's also active in fighting DSAL, and he has been running essentially a city council campaign for 2012, which for me has its good side and has its bad side. As for what the last speaker, Jacob, said about the sleeping bans being lifted, resulting in a huge influx of people to town, I think that is a myth. But it's hard to tell what would actually happen until it actually was lifted. I know that there was no such influx reported in Santa Barbara in 1986 when the sleeping ban was lifted there, nor in Miami in 1991 and 1998 when it was lifted there. Nor in Los Angeles and San Diego, and the sleeping ban was lifted a few years ago in both those places for nighttime sleeping. So the claim often made by former Mayor Mike Rodkin that this would bring every homeless Tom, Dick, and Janie to town to crash on the wonderful streets of Santa Cruz, I think is scare stories, exaggeration, and a misunderstanding of the facts of what brings people to town are job opportunities, family ties, things of that sort. I guess maybe better GA assistance opportunities that could happen up in the Bay Area. But that doesn't happen so much in Santa Cruz because that's just not what goes on here. Although some people do come here because of the family ties they have, or they become homeless here and they stay here because of the ties and the connections they've made. And there's a lot of stats about the number of homeless people, significant number of them being the number of people who actually, you know, were housed here before and became homeless in Santa Cruz. Because as people may remember, we're still in the midst of a deep recession. In spite of all the cheery news and tales of upturns and all that, more and more stores are getting boarded up, or vacant, I should say, at least. And, you know, it's more and more, you know, prices are still dropping in the real estate market, and it's no fun out there for a lot of folks. Anyway, again, the call-in number here is 427-3772. And let's hear a little more from the street.
Redwood?
Redwood, what you got for me?
I was skateboarding up the street of Pacific Avenue. About 12 o'clock noon, I was headed to an appointment. And the cop seen me down at Taco Bell, and he waved to me as I was going towards traffic up a one-way. And I thought that he waved as meaning, oh, hey, come over to this side, get into the right lane, you know, on the right side of the road. Mm-hmm. So I continued to follow the police officer about three blocks, you know, and not knowing that skateboarding is a crime on...
Now, was he walking against traffic?
Or? No, he was in his car.
You followed him in his car.
And he kind of just... like pulled his hand towards me as like, come here. And I thought it meant, well, just skateboard on the other side of the grass on the one way headed north.
What happened then?
Well, then he stops his car and pulls me over, and he didn't even tell me skateboarding was illegal. You know, if I had known, I wouldn't have been skating. But he wrote me a ticket and then proceeded to run my name, and he wanted to get into my bag. And I said, you can't go into my bag. And I told him that I had an expensive lawyer and whatnot, and he'd have to go through some shit to, you know, break the law.
What did he say, and what did he do?
Well, that's when he backed down. And I took my ticket over to Jack's Burger Shack, and I used it as dipping tray for my mustard and mayonnaise for my hamburger.
And when was this festive occasion?
It was 2 days ago.
At what time of day?
One or two o'clock.
You remember the name of the cop?
He was a heavier set guy. He looked like a rookie. He didn't really know what he was doing. He was just being a real asshole, just giving me a ticket because he could.
And how long have you been in town?
1 week.
What do you think otherwise?
Ooh, it was the I think it was the second day I got to town I got the ticket.
Sort of a warm welcome.
Warm welcome to Santa Cruz. Here's a $60 skateboarding ticket for not knowing. And set aside the fact there's signs every 20 feet that say no doing this or doing that, but there's not enough signs to say no skateboarding. If you're gonna have a no skateboarding law, yeah, you gotta have a sign every 10 feet, because when you're on a skateboard you're going fast, you know. It would be like putting a no driving sign on a road, you know what I mean? Like a big sign that says, you know, no skateboarding. They got these miniature tiny little signs about maybe one every block. You know, hidden behind a tree or something.
Sleeping outside, are you sleeping illegally at night?
Sleeping on the streets is not illegal.
Oh, yeah. In Santa Cruz, sleeping on any public property after 11 o'clock at night is an infraction.
Yeah, but infraction's not illegal to me.
Fair enough. We've been talking with...
Redwood.
Thank you, Redwood. We're talking with...
LJ.
And the kitty is...
Delilah.
How old is this Delilah kitty?
Delilah, I think, is 4 weeks old.
Oh, she's such a cute little kitty. Look at her with the blue eyes and the tawny head. Mm-hmm. Have you been...
I've been homeless for... on and off for 3 years. I worked for a year and a half. And, yeah, lost that job in summer 2009, so... been at the shelter, and that's ridiculous.
Tell me about why that's ridiculous.
The whole cycle of helping the homeless is pretty much seems like a...
We're going to get a picture of you and your kitty, by the way. Watch out.
You do it like that.
Look at me.
Look at
me. You look at me, too.
Okay.
Cool.
I feel it's just a cycle, you know, once people are in it, it's just a, kind of a setup for a failure. There's Project Reconnect that's given to help people financially, but you have to be working, and if you don't have a job, then you have no assistance. I've called and tried every angle and resources to just get assistance. 47 years old.
A youthful 47.
Yeah, thank you. I don't feel that way. But, and the shelter is a personalities before principles for sure.
And, tell me how that manifests itself. In your case, for instance.
In my case,
well, if you want in somebody else's case, but how do you give us a concrete example of what you mean by that?
Example. Okay, Paige Smith. Paige Smith is a housing for low income, which means you pay a third of your income for housing, which is awesome. I've lived there in the past. I have been there, and that worked out fine. And today, it is filled with people that are on SSI, SDI, because that is...
sure income.
Yep. So it's more of a, like...
funding source for the...
disability. Yeah, and there's no openings for anybody that could, you know, that needs it, like me, if I had the job. I just feel like people that are employable, you know, are not collecting that fixed income, struggling, can't find a job, just slip through the cracks.
How long you been in Santa Cruz?
I've been in Santa Cruz since 1988. I have two teenage daughters I've had at Dominican Hospital. They're 17 and 19. One's at Soquel High School, and one is attending Cabrillo.
Have they abandoned you as the homeless mom, the ne'er-do-well?
No. No, they love me. just due to circumstances and long story, CPS, I can't live with my 17-year-old, unfortunately, due to alcohol abuse, which I no longer do and haven't for...
You don't seem drunk.
I'm not. I don't get drunk anymore. Don't do that.
Marijuana use?
Yeah, and no.
A little bit,
yeah. I'm over it.
You're kind of a kitty fetishist.
Right now, yeah. I've become a mom again, so... no, my oldest daughter actually came over after work last night and met me downtown and brought me some food that she works at Dairy Queen in Capitola. And brought me a meal and...
You fed her, now she'll feed you.
She's feeding me, yeah. So my kids are awesome. I raised them good. And they don't do drugs and they're smart kids, so...
She's got shit jobs at the moment.
Yeah. Well, she's going to school to be a forensic anthropologist and she's into a lot of things. She's, yeah. So, the other's in high school.
What have you learned lately on the streets and the community that you might want to pass on to people?
Oh, boy.
If anything.
Pass on. Don't get frustrated. Don't take it out on others. And... You know, as a huge homeless community here in Santa Cruz, it's really about working together. And especially for women, it's really dangerous to be out here as a female.
You've suffered assaults yourself. You don't have to answer that kind of question.
No, not assaults, but, you know, a lot of people want to take care of you, you know, for a price. And that don't work.
You tried that.
No, yeah, well, I've been, yeah, asked that many a time, and it's just like, no. So
much for my plans.
Well, sorry.
Again, we've been talking with...
LJ.
And LJ, anything you want to add before we leave you here on the grass in front of Calvary Episcopal, leaning on your backpack?
Leaning on my backpack. Yeah, it's really cold out here, and, you know, people... For what it's worth, you know, really try not to label, all homeless people as transients and a problem to society, because there's a lot of us out here that have our wits and are not, drug addict, going crazy, ripping off, stealing, being criminals. There's not, and we could really use some help, and I'm really sick of being lumped together, watched by the cops, because of who you're hanging out with, and the only people out here, you know, mostly are people that are trying to make a buck, you know, to get by. So, yeah.
Have you had any problems with police recently?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. I don't.
So they leave you alone?
They leave me alone. They come by and check, you know, wherever people are sitting, you know, and I happen to meet people. I don't hang with any certain person or any people, so I know lots of people in Santa Cruz. I've been here a long time, and I, you know, just kind of float around. And they come by and check me out, and I'm not doing anything wrong, so it's all good. Yeah.
Well, you hope you don't sleep at night after 11. That, as you know, is illegal.
Yes, I just got booted out of a place I was at last night at probably midnight, 1 o'clock, which really sucked. I was sound asleep. It was all good. Wasn't making any noise. Wasn't bothering anybody. They really didn't have to do that.
Who booted you out?
Santa Cruz Police Department.
Well, wait a minute. These are the kindly police who never bother you.
Well, yeah. Well, apparently this place that I was at got blown up from some people recently that weren't doing so cool. And
is it indoors or outdoors?
It's outdoors in a vacant building.
Is there a lot of squatting going on in Santa Cruz?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah, you know. You can have us moving around, but we're not going away. So, you know, it's crazy. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. As conservative as Santa Cruz is trying to be and money-making, they're making money off of us.
We're spending money on you.
Well, yeah, they're spending money, but, you know, they're also revenue coming in, you know.
What revenue are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of revenue like the mental health and the cycle of being put in jail or being put in, being arrested, having to do programs, trying to get every, you know, anything out of, you know, nothing. There is some money into it. I think there's also a lot of crooked cops. Sorry, but...
criticizing our police force?
A few, yes.
Watch your tongue, young woman.
That's okay.
Again, we have been speaking with...
LJ.
Thanks, LJ. Just for Winston. Calling the streets. And a man with a table of petitions here. Illegally situated within 10 feet of a building.
The, but it's not even, there's no business here.
I know. And I'm glad they
know. Isn't that like...
No, it's still illegal. They don't know it. They're so stupid they don't know it. That's
like,
good.
Isn't that like an act... But if it's an active business, then... But if there's nobody...
Any
in
building, building. Any building. So pay no attention, though, because as long as they don't ticket you, you're fine. So.
I need the address.
Besides, if you're registering voters as well, you can always get a federal lawsuit against them if you know any... Good lawyers. So what exactly are you doing here? This is a...
We're trying to make it so that there's a primary election convention online, along with the televised conventions, just for the primary election in California. It'd be on AmericaSelect.org, and they're going to have live debates and stuff at the convention. And
this crazy system that leaves only two candidates at the end of all the primaries and kills all the minor parties?
Pretty much.
Ridiculous. And your name, sir?
My name's Oscar.
And Oscar, would you... As a petition signature, be interested in taking a petition around that would end the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban?
Yes.
Because I'm considering coming out on the streets and offering to trying to get that initiative going.
Hey, Robert, how's it going?
Good, good.
Well, sure. I was part of the protest last year at City Hall and up at the courthouse, and yeah, I'm totally excited for you to show me some papers, petitions.
I will try to show you my papers later.
Right.
We've been talking with...
Excuse me?
Your name again?
Oscar.
Thanks, Oscar. And if you want to check out Oscar's petitions for the American Elect petition to participate in the primary election, you'll be here in front of the dead but not forgotten Borders building?
Yes, yes. I'll be on Pacific Avenue.
Perhaps illegally, but nonetheless, our man. No, it's not. Some free art. Donations are...
And indeed, what happened was that... I'm passing in the last few days the same spot. I haven't seen anybody there with a table set up, even though the Borders building is still completely vacant and there's no business going in and out. But again, there's a 14-foot no-sitting zone, 10-foot no-tabling or street performing with a display device zone around every building in all business districts in Santa Cruz, thanks to the Downtown Association and their friends on the Santa Cruz City Council.
Accepted. Very nice. Are you? You're actually creating art as we sit here. Your name, sir?
Joshua.
And Joshua, this is a nice display in front of Calpone on the sidewalk. I notice you do not have a display device. The sidewalk itself is your display device. Hence, it's legal for you to be next to a building. By my peculiar reading of the law, if you are, but you're still 10 feet away, so as to avoid any complications.
Any complications whatsoever.
Now, like, I see you have. There's 6 by 12 or something. There's 70-odd free art items here, small kind of 3 by 3 inch or 4 by 4 inch squares of different artwork you've done. Now, these are reprints or original? These are reprints.
These are reprints that come from a self-published book of art and poetry.
Is your own book?
Which is my own book that I created.
And your name is?
Joshua Lab.
And Joshua, how long have you been showing your free art here on the streets of Santa Cruz?
Off and on for 3 years.
Fair enough. And how's biz, so to speak?
At the moment, slow, but it comes and goes with the karma of the world.
Indeed. Recently, two officers, Forbes and Winston, walked by. Did they stop to admire your art?
Oh, no. They gave a glance and kept on trucking, so I'm fine with that.
Don't you want to inspire our police force?
No, they can get art lessons somewhere else.
Well, a sad conclusion for these two art-starved officers. Again, we've been talking with...
Joshua.
And Joshua, are you online? Can people find your stuff there at all?
Yes, you can go to joshualab.com and check out 90 pages of the book, Notes to and from the Universe.
Joshua Lab is spelled?
joshualab.com.
Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you.
No, we don't want to do the history.
No.
So here we are downtown. A large police vehicle is parked here. And we have a couple of first alarm guy and a... So what's this all about? What's this vehicle?
This little community center. Yeah, they bring reports, stuff like that.
And so is this sort of
a... stickers and balloons to give.
That sounds nice. This is a long... How would we describe this vehicle? This is a kind of a... It's a large... Well, it's being hauled by another vehicle. It looks like a portable office. And are you going to be here every day, or is this a one-time event? Oh, okay. What's the story? Are you going to be here every day or a one-time event?
We just started out today to talk to people, just like do a little community outreach type of thing. Uh-huh. We'll probably bring it out again. People really want us to like do fingerprints for little kids and that kind of stuff. So.
What about the big kids?
You want your fingerprints taken, Robert?
Well, I already had my fingerprints taken, Officer Wilson.
Wow.
So, you've been out here for how long? How long has the vehicle been here?
It's been here since this morning.
Okay. And how many people would you say you've demonstrated fingerprints to?
Well, no, we don't have any fingerprint kits right now, but people have been showing interest, so that's probably something we'll do in the future when we bring it out again.
Okay.
Today was just so people can come talk to us and see our command post.
This is your, that's what this is, a
command post. Yeah, this is a mobile command post.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
You take care.
And, of course, the unasked question is, how much does this huge mobile command post that was parked on Soquel at the corner of... Soquel and Pacific, next to the abandoned Borders building, or the vacant Borders building. How much does it actually cost? There are pictures of this, video of this, posted online by Lee the Loiterer, as I call him, on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. He has some caustic comments to make about this. The name of his story online is A Barren Place, Santa Cruz Bookstore Replaced by Police Substation Razor Ray Gun, which is his nom de plume, and it's gotten about 12 comments on the Santa Cruz Indie Media website, his video. I'll play a little of his commentary for you to hear. You can check it out. You probably need to go see the video he's made. And at the time he was doing the video, there were nobody was on the street, but... there were no jewelry people selling or singers singing. And he concluded from that the police substation had kind of driven people away, which it may well have done, although when I was there later, there were people who had returned or who were there again. So it's really kind of, for me, it's really hard to judge what the actual, you know, drop in or rise in people on the streets is. I have a real hard time with that. Some people have a much more definite impression, and I kind of value that impression. But let's hear a little of Lee's online video. And I'm kind of booting it up right now. Again, you can go to it by going to indiebay.org/Santa Cruz.
A week ago, the Borders books that you're seeing on the left-hand side here closed due to economic circumstances. The street corner you're looking at, except for that change... machine, where they claim it's an ATM, the street corner used to be filled with street performers and people selling crap.
And unfortunately, it kind of looks like we've got a video that's going to stop every 3 minutes, so I'm going to kind of end it here.
It is now.
Because it's not, I don't know, it's going to be a little difficult to listen to. There are numerous comments online, though, a lot of them recent from today, and one guy who seems to be a supporter of the police van writes, the following: beggars, drug addicts, crazy meth head girls spitting on cops, grungy Trustafarian slackers with their blonde dreads and their malnourished puppies asking me to pay for their beer by begging while they had daddy's credit card in their pocket, drunks sleeping in between bouts of sharing their cardboard sign that asked me for my hard-earned money so they could get their next round of booze. Good riddance on all counts. And that's by the guy who writes, "You saw street performers and people settling crafts, but I saw..." And then one next guy writes, "Kick pigs out. Revolt, revolt everywhere." Another one writes, "Your tax dollars wasted again. Nice cop watch. Anti-imperial." That's also the sort of the pseudonym of Ray and Lee. "Not completely barren, though. The cops bought some cute balloons. The cops in Santa Cruz waste way too much taxpayer money on nothing." And another one person writes, "I don't see anything in that video to suggest that people actually stopped hanging out in that corner due to the cops. No interviews, no people being asked to move along by police, nothing." Another one writes, "I wonder what time the video was shot. The people I saw were bundled up, which would suggest early morning. That is the case would explain the lack of people hanging out. Shops aren't open. There's no one to sell to or beg from. Most of the folks who hang out at downtown don't get up until noonish." "Crisis averted," writes one writer. "Took a walk today and there was no van there. Good job scaring them off. Time of the video is a good question to ask. I was down around 10:30 in the morning and the mall was still pretty dead." And then Video Man reports, "The video was done at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 11th, when the, there's a bunch of photo that I'm not sure much of, convicts doing slave labor, apparently, which doesn't have too much to do with the issue, except maybe in a deeper and more symbolic sense. And there's a debate between Razor Raygun, which is Lee, who writes, "Hi, troll. I could write a book about the cause and effect of a shitty overpriced shopping mall that uses college student labor, consistently not hiring local youths to sell their worthless crap to other college students on a community barren of jobs that pay the rent for even a hovel, while controlling the price of housing via UCSC's transient college students whose parents used to buy houses around here for the time their children were in school, but have been reduced to leasing substandard condo units for the same type of tax breaks, and even more transient QB workers who can simply write off the exorbitant rents as a business expense because they don't live anywhere near here. Of course there were people on the streets. There's no work that pays the rent. The video and my comments stand just as they are. If you don't like them or believe they're somehow misleading, it's just too fucking bad. Make a counter-argument or simply shut the fuck up." To which another person replies, "What is it that you do to be a productive member of the community? Are you yet another one of the parasitic low-life whiners here that can't understand why you just can't have everything he or she wants? Maybe you ought to quit your sniveling and complaining and try learning how to do something that pays well, or go somewhere else where all the good jobs are." Of course, for my money, Lee did a very good job of answering that whole thing with a brief, but I think pungent, analysis of the job situation in Santa Cruz. And another person writes, "It would be interesting in learning more about writing my rent off as a business expense. Do you have any facts to back this claim up? In my experience, the only people writing their rents or mortgages off as a business expense are self-employed and also use their domiciles as places of business, such as child care providers, graphic web designers, therapists. Give me one concrete example where employees are able to write off their rent as a business expense. I'm not looking for a hypothetical or a theoretical example. Cite an actual case of a QB who is entitled to the benefit. Otherwise, you're just making empty claims. Finally, who are you to be the judge of what is or isn't worthless crap? Isn't that what the marketplace is all about? If someone buys it, it has value. If they don't, it doesn't, and the business eventually dies. And are business owners supposed to consult with you before they stock their shelves?" A little defensive there. And then there's a response, again, by a person criticizing the video poster. "And the best you could do is call me a troll. I did try to mock your over-the-top style. Cube workers actually are worse off than labor camp inmates, whatever, but I doubt that rises to the level. You give one data point and claim that it proves that the SCPD is running people off. I had another point, removing the variable of the HQ, but with the same time and have the same result, nobody on the corner. At 3:30 today, it was much warmer, and the traffic on Pacific was heavier. You had one person collecting signatures and two different people selling their wares, which leads to the question of how many fucking hemp bracelets can a town of this size support? Same question goes to those guys doing the spray paint art as well. Claiming that the evil police van was the reason seems to be dishonest. And there's another writer who, again, is looking for, wants to see the, who criticizes Lee's commentary. But I encourage people to follow this debate because it's very interesting. It's on Indie Bay. But indeed, it has the makings of a debate by those who are sort of free enterprise, business is great, we like the police, why don't those homeless go somewhere else, or why don't those street people go somewhere else group, versus those who are suggesting that the whole economy is creating a massive underclass of people who are driven onto the streets, can't pay the rents, and that the main stuff sold on Pacific Avenue is essentially knickknacks for the tourist trade that doesn't really serve a lot of the local community or offer a lot of local jobs here. Important debate. I don't have a lot of facts on it. I should have more. But I do comment on it now and then. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. And, of course, the name of the show is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. I'm your very favorite Bathrobes Pierre, or perhaps your least favorite Bathrobes Pierre, depending on who you are. I'm going to, before I go into more discussion, and there's not really a lot of new stuff around the settlement discussion, the issue of the sleeping ban proposal that I put before the city council, that they want to drop at least part of the lawsuit, if they want to have that amount of money removed, that they take action to end the sleeping ban. That there's a few new points there, and we did a little more, a little interviewing today on that subject. I'll probably do a little bit more tomorrow in front of Bookshop Santa Cruz, probably around noon if you're interested. But not a lot. So I was thinking of actually doing a flashback, which means going back to a sort of another era, almost a decade ago. But before I do, let me do what I was asked to do by one listener who wants me to talk about a little bit about the upcoming slut walk. And it's not really something I know a great deal about because I haven't interviewed anybody who's organizing it. But I can tell you what I've read on Santa Cruz Indie Media, and I encourage you to go check it out. There's a slut walk Santa Cruz planned for 12 p.m. on Saturday, May 14th, day after tomorrow. And how that's described is it's going to start at the clock tower in downtown Santa Cruz. And the article reads, and it's on IndieBay.org or Santa Cruz IMC, Santa Cruz Indie Media Collective, because we've had enough. On January 24th, 2011, a representative of the Toronto Police gave shocking insight into the force's view of sexual assault by stating women should avoid dressing like sluts in order not to be victimized. As the city's major protective service, the Toronto Police have perpetuated the myth and stereotype of the slut, and in so doing have failed us. With sexual assault already a significant underreported crime, survivors now have been given even less of a reason to go to the police for fear they could be blamed. Being assaulted isn't about what you wear, it's not even about sex, but using a pejorative term to rationalize inexcusable behavior creates an environment in which it's okay to blame the victim. And, of course, after the City Council's Tuesday new low in refusing to even issue the most mild advisory to the county to opt out of the dump undocumented illegal aliens, that is to say, human beings who've lived here and are guilty of minor infractions and are probably a meaningful part of the workforce, to dump them into the immigration juggernaut machine, I should say the deportation machine, that is run by the federal government, the ICE programs, is it's incredible. The city council, for the first time I've seen, refused to even take a symbolic stand in favor of what was said by the overwhelming majority of people who came to the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. And I'm pausing with this kind of brief tirade, this interruption of the discussion of the slut walk, to note that this is another example of how police, and this was one of the arguments that was used by the people at the city council who came with this resolution, saying, look, don't pick up people for minor offenses and turn them over to the ICE, because they'll be deported without a lawyer and without a trial. And it's a way of breaking up families, a way of destroying lives, because of minor offenses, infractions even, anything that the police have decided to pick you up for and take you to the jail for. And it discourages, just like this kind of discussion up in Toronto's characterization of blaming of women who dress in what the Toronto police consider a provocative manner, for assaults on them, it discourages use of the police force. And perhaps that's a good thing, because I don't think the police force is terribly helpful in most cases. There are exceptions, and I've been helped by the police on occasions in retrieving a vehicle, for instance. But I've often heard cases of people who, the police who and sheriffs particularly, just don't show up in time for a real crime, and yet spend a lot of time harassing poor and homeless people for bogus complaints that simply have to do with some sort of middle-class fantasy about the Disneyland that should be around us. Anyway, continuing with this slut walk discussion. Historically, the term slut has carried a predominantly negative connotation aimed at those who are sexually promiscuous, be it for work or pleasure. It has primarily been women who have suffered under the burden of this label, and whether dished out as a serious indictment of one's character or merely as a flippant insult, the intent behind the word is always to wound, so we're taking it back. Slut is being reappropriated. We are tired of being oppressed by slut-shaming, of being judged by our sexuality and feeling unsafe as a result. Being in charge of our sexual lives should mean that we are opening ourselves to an expectation of violence. Should not mean that we are opening ourselves to an expectation of violence. Regardless if we participate in sex for pleasure or work, no one should equate enjoying sex with attracting sexual assault. We are a movement demanding that our voices be heard. We are here to call foul on our police force and demand change. We want Toronto Police Services to take serious steps to regain our trust. We want to feel that we'll be respected and protected should we ever need them. But more importantly, we be certain that those charged with our safety have a true understanding of what it is to be a survivor of sexual assault, slut or otherwise. We are tired of speeches filled with lip service and then apologies that accompany them. What we want is meaningful dialogue, and what we are doing, and we are doing something about it. We are coming together, not only as women, but as people from all gender expressions and orientations, all walks of life, levels of employment and education, all races, ages, abilities, and backgrounds, from all points of this city and elsewhere. We are asking you to join us for Slut Walk, to make a unified statement about sexual assault and victims' rights, and to demand respect for all. You needn't claim the word slut for yourself, whether a fellow slut or simply an ally. You don't have to wear your sexual proclivities on your sleeve. We just ask that you come. Any gender identification, any age, singles, couples, parents, sisters, brothers, children, friends, come walk or roll or strut or holler or stomp with us. I just don't sleep after 11 o'clock at night, of course. Luckily, this is happening at noon on Saturday. Join us in our mission to spread the word that those who experience sexual assault are not the ones at fault, without exception. And there's a picture we're taking slut back, which is all very well. I wish there were something local about how local police are treating people rather than just sort of a theoretical vague connection with, you know, Toronto, which is, you know, I mean, what's been happening locally? I always ask that question because I think it's far more pertinent than what's happening in Toronto, although I'm sure that the same kinds of things are probably happening around here. Slut that I am, in many ways. So, who knows? Where will I be on Sunday at noon? Probably not on Slut Walk, but I'll try to cover it one way or another, particularly if anybody wants to call in and talk about it. If we have any sluts or slut simps, slut sympathizers out there, who want to discuss what the experiences they've had in Santa Cruz, please do call in 427-3772, 427-3772, and we'll chat on the air about this issue. And while I'm waiting for that, I'm going to play a few more reports from the street.
Well, today is May 11th, I believe. It is a Wednesday in front of New Leaf Market, and I'm not sure what time it is. Probably around 6 or 7, and we're talking with
Jason.
Jason, you're a man with a guitar. You're seated on your own milk crate or somebody's milk crate, and you have a guitar case in front of you with all of $1.75 arrayed in coins. How's the business today?
Today's about average. You know, it's farmer's market day, so it was a little bit better than average, but, you know, it all works out about the same.
And what's your average take for a day, and how many hours do you play?
It depends on how many hours I play, but if I stay out all day, play 12 to 14 to 16 hours, you know, I'll get my issue. I'll get 20, 25 bucks.
That's
on average.
Wow, that's pretty low wage, actually.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you get from doing this? I mean, you get hot dates, you get pastries and other collectible foods, meaningful spiritual counsel.
I get lots of meaningful spiritual counsel, and I do get lots of leftovers from restaurants. People
exciting
offer
training from the police who come up when the rookies train on you.
I get my lessons in authority figures every day because, you know, they like to bounce you around and move you along and all that fun stuff.
Have you been moved along today?
No. I pretty much got the spots down where they leave me alone.
And you've been sitting here in front of New Leaf for how long?
About an hour now.
So today is not one of your 12-hour days?
Well, like I say, you move around a lot. So, like, I've already been playing for about 6-7 hours today because I played over by the market for a couple hours. I played this morning for a couple hours. I'll be playing until probably 11 o'clock tonight. So.
And give us an example of the kind of music you play.
Okay. This is what I'm working on right now.
Position?
Yeah, it's just a bunch of chords I'm stringing together, and just, you know, it's just like a jam, basically. I'm just jamming.
You're sort of a jazz man of the streets.
Yeah, I just kind of make it up as I go and throw parts together and mix and match stuff, and I don't sing, so.
You haven't sung yet. We're still waiting for your voice to emerge.
I'm predominantly an instrumentalist. I'm not a vocalist, so I'm more comfortable just playing.
And we've been talking with
Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
So I'm talking with a man on the street who has his view of this sleeping band lawsuit. You think that the reason they're not doing it is because this is a form of class warfare?
Yes.
Thank you. And that that was the thought of actually a vet, an older vet, who had that thought. And we're talking about the lawsuit and the offer to settle the lawsuit without... by ending the sleeping band, the lawsuit involving the mock Nazi salute. And we're approaching two musicians who are playing here in front of the defunct Borders. Let's hear a little bit of the music here. Two musicians, actually. It's Vision Song Valerie and Swami of the Strings. I forgot what chord. Next to Asana on the F, the sexy sounds of a sax player I haven't seen before is doing some tooting. And there you have it. Turn to slow speed.
front of the bookshop Santa Cruz on May 12th, 2011. I'm a little year ahead of myself. But soon it'll be 2012. And we have this Ernest Hupster's Paul Robert, two Roberts, and
Casey Living Good.
Interested Living Good. Yes, the Living Good Man. Now, it's a beautiful sunny day. We're just, in typical Huff manner, we're preparing slowly to do a petitioning for people to have the option to sign up for support for the settling the lawsuit, which is before the city council, and the city council wants to go to the Supreme Court. We'll see what happens. We're a little slow today, and we may actually be moving this to tomorrow or later today, perhaps, when we actually have all the implements necessary to do this. But we do have our literature, and if you want to call into the station to ask more about this issue, you certainly can. It's probably been discussed ad nauseum, but 427-3772 is...
And that indeed is the number. I'm going to stop here briefly because indeed, since we're probably going to be taking this petition, I'm practically are going to be taking the petition back to the sidewalk, not just in front of the bookshop Coonerty or Santa Cruz, as I put it, but also to hopefully some spots where there's considerably more people coming and going. We may even end up at Trader Joe's and find ourselves arrested for exercising our First Amendment rights to petition. We'll see what happens there. That may come up in the near future. Maybe the ACLU, which won't protect its own members there when they were so threatened and actually so ticketed, we get to watch as they don't protect us either. But what I wanted to do is to read you what this petition says. It's a petition of the Santa Cruz City Council, and it's going to be online soon if it's not already. In a time of financial crisis with more and more people becoming homeless, please settle this costly lawsuit with Robert Norris, me. Do not waste taxpayer money on further appeals and trials. Accept his proposal to reform the council rules and end the sleeping ban. We need to save money rather than save face. And then has a place for people to sign up. There's also, I think, an important secondary petition or actually list that people are being invited to sign up on, which is a volunteer list to see who really wants to get serious about this, not just present an expression of opinion to the city council that the city council will ignore, but an initiative petition that will seek to get the 3,500 to 4,000 votes of registered city voters that are needed to actually put this issue on the ballot and require the city council to act and to settle this issue. And here's a longer piece of literature, which is actually a condensation of an article which I wrote on Santa Cruz Indie Media, which I invite people to check out. The name of that article is, if I can find it here, City Council Won't Settle, will now spend thousands more in Fitzmaurice's hissy fit case. And I've titled this flyer, City Spend Thousands More in Former Mayor's Hissy Fit. We have a grammatical problem in the first sentence, but I won't get into that. This is a condensed story. City Council won't settle the 9-year-long legal battle in the Norris versus City of Santa Cruz mock Nazi salute case. It hasn't even made a counteroffer. Instead, in two closed sessions, it authorized more thousands to be spent on an East Coast legal firm to prepare an unlikely appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's unlikely to succeed because the court accepts less than 5% of the cases that that are laid before it, as my understanding. Their hope is to overturn an 11-member en banc panel decision which found I have a right to take three mayors to trial for repressive behavior at city council. City authorities want to recover a mayor's right to exclude a member of the public, as former Mayor Fitzmaurice did in March 2002 in what two judges called Fitzmaurice's hissy fit. Background. The issue is city council's power to use the threat of arrest for characterizing the mayor's behavior as Nazi-like, even in the absence of an actual disruption of the meeting. My crime, for which I was arrested but never charged, was raising my left arm briefly in a silent, don't act like a bunch of fascists, mock Nazi salute that the mayor didn't notice and the sergeant-at-arms ignored. That 2-second incident was over 9 years ago. Last December, a rare 11-member panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ordered the city to go to a long-delayed trial, a trial against three mayors for falsely arresting me at city council, because I was indeed arrested for doing that. A video of the two-second incident made by activist Becky Johnson can be viewed at, and then there's a website you can go to. The case has already cost the city attorney's office around $150,000. I had originally asked them to simply change the council rules to reflect a citizen's First Amendment right to register a dissenting opinion. I'd asked them to pay minimal attorney's fees and then pay punitive and compensatory damages for the false arrest. The city council's intent, however, now seems to be to maintaining the power to frighten critics into sitting obediently in council with hands folded and mouths shut, and fitting all their remarks into increasingly short public comment periods without indecorous language. Applause, for example, is permitted. Boos are not. And a lot was made of this in the Sentinel article, that somehow it's a disruptive to boo, but it's not disruptive to applaud. And that one is permitted, but the other is not, which is, of course, clearly content-based and illegitimate form of repression at city council, particularly because it favors whatever the city council is doing. If you applaud them and celebrate them, you're okay. If you boo or hiss, you're not. Even though it seems to me, however we like to think that this is being a gentleman's and gentlewoman's situation where everybody behaves in a very decorous manner, the reality is that what's happening up at the city council are life decisions that have meaningful effects on all of us, and we have a right to have input into, and we have a right to respond to. Just simple as that. That's always been my belief. That's how I've conducted myself at city council, and that's why I was arrested, because I did that. I didn't do it in such a way as to stop the meeting. I did it. The meeting was stopped because I did it, and they wanted to make a signal example that this was not permitted behavior, and that people would be punished for it, even though it is their First Amendment right. The city attorney's office rejected any meaningful changes in the council's repressive rules. My specific settlement offer was that oral communications be restored to 3 minutes. That's the period of time people can actually talk to the city council about what they want. Placed again at regular evening session, and now it's in a strange ghetto period at the end at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Allowed on a first-come, first-served basis instead of sending activists to the back of the line, which violates the Public Meetings Act anyway, and adopting the Board of Supervisors' policy of letting everyone speak, even if it meant extending the time of the meeting. I also wanted the elimination of the so-called decorum rules instituted by Hissy Fit Fitzmaurice when he was mayor in 2001, which empowers council members to interrupt and threaten speakers who speak candidly or harshly, because they talk about indecorous language and things of that sort. Most important, I wanted it made crystal clear that a violation of a council rule cannot be used to threaten eviction or arrest unless it materially disrupts the meeting, a key part of the Ninth Circuit Court decision. It's already the law that the council can't arrest unless there's a real disruption, not one they create by themselves by claiming a rule violation. In addition, I asked for some damages for false arrest to discourage this from happening to the next critic, and attorney's fees, which have mounted up hugely over the last 9 years and will continue to mount in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Instead of settling, the city attorney's office hired Richard Ruda, and it could be Rudo. I don't know what his name. I think I got the, not clear if that's the proper spelling, which I think I got from the Sentinel. Former chief counsel of the state and local legal center in Washington, presumably a high-powered Maryland attorney, to defend the indefensible. And I give various suggestions about contacting the mayor. I, in fact, offered on Tuesday, May 10th, to drop all my personal financial demands in return for dropping the sleeping and blanket bans, setting up campgrounds, and dropping all past camping citations. Support me, I asked, by signing the petition. If City Council refuses, as it refuses to protect the rights of renters, poor people outside, and immigrants, join us in putting the issue on the ballot with initiative petitions. And because there was a kind of an unusually positive response both in the Sentinel, because the Sentinel wrote two stories about it and had me pictured twice with a fine mugshot, and because the poll there actually had me winning the vote, although there are suspicions that some people voted more than once on this issue, so I'm not sure how legitimate this poll was on either side. And because people who I hadn't talked to in years expressed interest and support for this offer that I made of dumping the sleeping ban in return for, I should say, dropping my own financial demands on city council, which I guess are anywhere between $20,000 and $100,000 for false arrest. And if they simply change the law that will allow homeless people to sleep not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, establish legal sleeping zones and campgrounds and so forth, where people can safely and legally sleep without harassment by the police or troll busters or, you know, people crowding into the same sleeping bag, for that matter, or too near in their campsite and so forth. So this is particularly important in a time when people are losing their housing, obviously. And it's also important in a broader sense. In fact, I've been rethinking the whole use of the word homeless. I know people have said, well, hey, I'm not homeless. I'm houseless. In other words, the world is my home. And, you know, I appreciate the spiritual kind of impetus behind that, kind of the rainbow person aspect of that. And I've often, you know, taken the more limited position that as long as there isn't any legal shelter, you can't criminalize someone for falling asleep where they have to. And that seems to me to be a sort of a very simple, obvious, unchallengeable argument, but which city council and other authorities successfully ignore. But it really goes beyond that. And activists Ed Fry and other folks have brought to my attention that, and I've been aware of this for a long time, too, that it's not really whether the city is willing to provide some wretched, regimented shelter system as an alternative, and that somehow is going to justify rounding everybody up and harassing or arresting the rest of the people who don't use that shelter service but sleep somewhere else, even though they're not bothering anybody, they're not creating a fire or safety hazard, they're not leaving any litter, and so forth. But the fact that they're simply there becomes a crime under the camping ordinance, the actual act of sleeping after 11 o'clock becomes a crime just for sleeping, not even doing anything else, even if you don't have any camping gear or any blankets. You just fall asleep at 11:01. That's illegal in Santa Cruz, even in your own vehicle, you know, even in your front yard if you own a house, if it's visible from the street. Illegal. It's obviously wrong. And it seemed wrong to me for decades, but it's wrong, as I say, not just because of the issue of, well, you know, they don't have any shelter, so they have to do it, but it's wrong because this criminalizes a class of people, some of whom are homeless by economic necessity, they're displaced urban residents, some of whom have chosen, for different reasons, to live differently, and in living differently, they have a right to live differently. They have, in fact, they are seen perhaps, and there's a really interesting book on this I'm probably going to read from on Sunday. They have chosen to become transient and wanderers, some folks, as a matter of principle, some of it as a disaffiliating themselves from the war machine, from the slave labor machine that most people are tied into, from the rent racket that people have to pay every month. And I know there's a lot of resentment and castigating and labeling people as being slackers and lazy and bums and so forth because of this, because they're choosing to opt out of the system. But I think that that kind of political characterization is a bogus one. Let's put it this way. It's a biased one, and it shouldn't be how we impartially regard people. It shouldn't limit the rights we afford to people. And again, I'm going to be hopefully be talking about this more on Sunday. I have a flashback audio of a a video, actually, that was made. I believe it was made by Becky Johnson, or it was made by perhaps the Santa Cruz City Council and secured at some point by me or by activist Becky Johnson, way back from 2000 and... I guess it was 2003 when the City Council killed the Citizen Police Review Board. The Citizen Police Review Board was a board that was in power from 1994 or 5 until 2003. And the last chair of the board was an African-American activist who many people know in this community, Mark Half Moon. And he was interviewed on Becky's show, Club Cruise. And actually, I don't know if this interview was before or after the board was aborted by Rotkin, Matthews, Emily Riley, and all the great activists, actually, all the great city council members. They weren't activists. They were politicians of that day, none of whom are on the city council anymore. But their spirit still lives. There's no meaningful control of the police. The police force gets pretty much what it wants, although, of course, as the economic crunch deepens, it's attacking them as well. But we still see more cops on the beat, more security forces, more hosts downtown marching around, telling people where to sit and where to play and where not to play, and actually demanding they move along. And you heard some people talking about that in the interviews today. Here's a bit of a tape from the Club Cruise show. That was the show that activist Becky Johnson regularly hosted way back in, is this 2002 or 2003? Let's see where we're at with this.
The CPRB. What do you think the reason was that people were not filing so many complaints? Do you think there was just not a problem with police misconduct in the Santa Cruz Police Department, or do you think that there was some other reason?
Well, I think that, if you're talking about during the whole life of the board, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Or over the last
year?
Yeah,
and I realize that both of you were kind of at the end of the board, mm-hmm. and I maybe actually know more about some of the doings that happened previously because I had a lot of involvement as a citizen with the Citizens Police Review Board for the last few years.
I've had a lot of citizens say to me when I asked them, when people came to me and told me about their complaints, and even came to the vice chair and I kept office hours every Friday.
This, of course, is Mark Half Moon, who worked afterward at Community TV, and he's still active in trying to fight racism in the community, and was one of the people who spoke up in favor of Councilmember Tony Madrigal when he was roundly denounced for suggesting that he observe what appeared to be to him that may have been racial profiling in a Halloween incident some years back, and is one of the reasons that Councilmember Madrigal seems to vote against the huge massing of police and Klieg lights and so forth on Halloween, and the triple fine zones, as they're called. Again, I guess this sounds like a show that happened right after the board was abolished, and it was at that time that I really wanted Mark Half Moon to lead a Citizens Police Review Board in exile. He was the chair of the board right before it was abolished by the city council. And the board itself was not that effective. It had all kinds of problems. It never used the powers that it had, and it needed backbone. But it had begun to look into things like the police use of force, like racial and economic profiling, selective enforcement, and that probably was what sealed its doom.
Be board members present for someone to come in and talk to and possibly file a complaint. And a lot of people told us that over the years they've come to believe that there was no point in filing a complaint. You were signing a piece of paper, alerting the police to your unhappiness with the police department, and they feared retribution. Mm-hmm. And they didn't feel that we as a board could protect them. And I don't know what went on over the years, mm-hmm. but I have a feeling that lack of trust and confidence mm-hmm. in the board's ability to truly investigate a case and give a fair answer and protect the citizen from any kind of retribution that may be one of the causes. Mm-hmm.
I know that when I was working with my homeless clients a lot, that I would hear stories that were very caused me great concern. And if I had some sort of corroborating evidence or witnesses, and I knew that homeless person was not going to file a complaint, then I would file a complaint on their behalf. Just to circuit that same thing that you're talking about, people being afraid to, and so that an advocate can file a complaint on behalf of the client. And I think I filed 8 complaints in 8 years.
And I believe that can still be done for those who are interested, that it is still appropriate and legal to file a complaint on behalf of someone else, to say that you're concerned that this happened and you want to see it investigated. And I have actually not specifically inquired, and I probably should do that and may do that in the next few weeks, but put it on my to-do list to see if the police department has now decided to cut off that avenue. I doubt that's, if they have, that this is a legal or appropriate thing that they did, because I don't think the Citizens Police Review Board had the ovaries or the testicles to be able to cook up new and stronger police protections on their own. They didn't, really. They were always trying to, be pals with the police department and work things out and all that kind of thing, instead of oversee them as they should have. So I think that the fact that it was then allowed and required that if a complaint was made on behalf of someone, that still had to be accepted by the police, that's still the case. It wasn't that the CPRB, the Citizens Police Review Board, broke new ground on this issue.
But I never filed a complaint for police behavior to my individual self. It was on behalf of somebody else mm-hmm. in each case. So I
think that over the last year, what has been happening is that we as a board, new members have come on the board, mm-hmm. and it got kind of energized, and we started taking a more proactive approach. Mm-hmm. We started to try to examine why were we experiencing this frustration of looking through complaints and having no choice but to exonerate, because we're trying to be honest. But if the only information we have is the information given to us by the police department, and it's sanitized, and in case after case after case, it's explained how the person was mistaken or the person was wrong, the officer did the right thing. And I'm going, gosh, these guys don't need guns and badges, they need harps and wings, because they were like angels.
And well, there's new technology now, if you haven't noticed, in all the police cars. They have cameras that go on when their sirens and lights come on, and they stay on, and they all have little tape recorders in their pocket. Mm-hmm. So we did,
I believe this is Holly Hammond, who I believe is either on the board or connected to the board, I'm not sure her position, but she was on that show, and the third person, along with Becky and Mark.
We were having trouble with some of the timeline issues in one of the cases, so we requested the tape, the videotape. Now, it didn't show the actual action of the complaint, but the audio was there. And that really helped us, because the timeline was like a minute and a half, where the complaint, the way it was written, it made it out like it lasted 5 minutes, like the contact.
So are you saying that when you were reviewing this complaint, you realized that to sort it out, you needed to hear that tape, mm-hmm. but that wasn't already part of the IA investigation of that complaint?
Well, we had to request the tape, mm-hmm. yeah.
I felt that the investigation, the report we were given, was erroneous, and either it was through an act of incompetence or an act of deceit, because what we received was a transcript that purported to say what was going on, and one of the statements that was made in the transcript of what occurred was very incriminating toward the person who was arrested. It was under their name, and it was a quote that implied they were ready to commit violence. And so if you would casually look at this and you were just reading the complaint, as we did in the past before there were recordings, we would have said, ah, this looks pretty clear cut. But in this particular case, what the person was saying didn't seem consistent with what the rest of the things the person was saying. And so we requested the tape so that we could hear what was really being said. And as it turned out, it was not the person who was arrested who made the violent statement. It was actually a police officer. And that changed our whole perception.
Yeah, that was...
What's interesting about Mark's discussion is he is talking about something that is that happens in confidence in a closed hearing of the Citizens Police Review Board, that they're not supposed to be discussing outside the hearing. In fact, of course, this stuff should be available for the public to listen to. There should be public hearings on issues that are raised here. But this is all designed to protect the police officers and the blue code of silence and the employees of the government who are the enforcers of not just government policy, but often the whims of the cutting edge of the enforcers of the enforcement, the police department itself, that has may have little to do with actually enforcing the law, but has to do with simply justifying actions made by officers on the beat. And it took the abolition of the board for Mark and Holly, if I have her name right, to come out and actually start talking about these issues so heavy was the feeling that they had to keep all this stuff in confidence, even though what they're talking about is a very serious matter where police officers are apparently filing either erroneous or deceptive reports. This was back in 2002 that this took place. This discussion was in 2003, I think, but they're talking about their last year, which was 2002. What was needed, of course, was a change in the whole structure of the CPRB, or at least in the willingness of some members to speak out anyway around these issues and not be hedged in by kind of a code of silence imposed upon them by a police department that really wanted a CPRB that was simply a fig leaf and a cheering section for the police department, which, of course, we understand. Every department likes to think of itself as a well-run department and so forth, and an embattled department, and a department that needs to be, you know, given a lot of additional help and so forth.
It made us feel like, well, if this is the case, how many more of these cases are we getting false information? And sometimes questions would be asked, and you would be saying to yourself, well, ask the next question. Where's the follow-up? One person's saying A, I mean, all the witnesses. One says this, one says that, one says another, one says another. In the investigation, why doesn't the investigator go back to any of these people and try to corroborate it?
Right. That's just it. And now that the cars all have cameras, if you're ever contacted by a policeman, walk to the front of the car. So you are on camera. And there will be a record of your contact. So now that's really an important thing to think about, because, you know, it may prove something that otherwise would have been swept under the rug.
Now, I have seen a lot of cases of police videotaping on Pacific Avenue especially. I have a concern about that because, for instance, Sergeant Baker was taping for a two-day period a group of people that were just sort of gathering in front of a planter, and I felt kind of chilled and intimidated by that. The right of the people to peaceably assemble seemed to sort of violate that, since he wasn't in the course of contacting anyone or seeking information about a crime, or, well, I mean, maybe he was, but he was doing it so openly.
Well, all of us are television producers, and we're all aware of the fact that we have the right to videotape, or people have a right to videotape anything that's in public. And so that officer has the right to do that. one has to ask, what was the purpose of the taping? You could look at a person and remember their face and remember what they look like. You don't have to videotape them. But you said something about the way you felt. You felt intimidated.
Chilled and intimidated.
Chilled and intimidated. And I know for a fact that when you stick a camera in someone's face, as I have done before myself, mm-hmm. that person feels intimidated or mm-hmm. chilled.
Well, I don't think it's the same as, say, you or I out on the street with a video camera. The police officers are employees of the city of Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. They are beholden to policies in the police department. And is it the policy of the police to go to round groups of people they don't like and to aim cameras at them for hours and hours on end?
Good point. But will it be public knowledge when they put the very small cameras up on buildings that just mm-hmm. generally film whatever happens mm-hmm. during the day? So they can go back and look at these tapes.
Well, they have those too.
Where do we draw the line of, uh-huh. you know, expecting an explanation? Because they're going to put these cameras up there mm-hmm. that watch us all the time if they're not already there. So.
And it's nearly 20 years after 1984, and we know that Big Brother is alive, that the mm-hmm. government and private institutions, corporations are watching us and paying attention to everything we do. But I have a concept that I call Little Sister. Not everybody, but a lot of people can mm-hmm. afford small video cameras. Mm-hmm. And I encourage those people to go out into the streets and go to demonstrations or anytime they see any kind of violations of the law by officers or anyone to videotape it. Because it's indisputable evidence. However, it doesn't always work. Someone videotaped Rodney King getting the crap beat out uh-huh. of him, and still the jury found, and many of my European American brothers and sisters in the United States found that, well, that wasn't enough evidence.
Well, they shouldn't.
And it should be noted, just sort of as a sidelight. If you go to East Bay Indie Media, you'll find a story. Merzely likely to be released in early June. And this is Johannes Merzely. The former police officer was convicted of involuntary manslaughter for the fatal shooting, some say execution, of BART passenger Oscar Grant III on New Year's Day 2009, will likely walk free from jail next month in June. Former BART police officer Johannes Merzely will likely be granted an early release from prison during a June 1st hearing in L.A. Superior Court while only serving less than a year of a two-year sentence. The videotaped shooting sparked a series of protests and riots in Oakland in 2009 and 2010. Merzely's early release will likely be met with similar protests, according to a news interview with Oscar Grant's uncle, Cephas Johnson. A community response is already being planned. And that's going to be interesting to follow. Again, it was one of the rare cases where a police officer was even taken to court or trial for murder, or in this case, manslaughter. And this is there's an establishment news report that talks about this. It would be very painful emotionally just to see him not behind bars, and the fact that he is now seeking employment at Northern California, Oscar Grant's uncle, Cephas Johnson, said. The criminal trial for the New Year's Day 2009 shooting at the Fruitvale BART station ended last year, but the $50 million civil suit filed by the Grants family still moves forward. Tuesday, a U.S. District Court judge ordered the Transit Authority drop from the list of defendants, but individual officers like Merzely remain named in the suit, which means they're probably not going to get so much money. We will continue to make improvements to our police department to avoid something like this from happening again. BART Board of Directors President Bob Franklin said. Grant's family attorney says BART would still cover damages a judge or jury awards. From our point of view, this case was always about Perrone and Merzely. Those are the two officers, John Burris, the attorney, said. U.S. Department of Justice has not finished its separate investigation into whether Grant's civil rights were violated. Merzely could still face a federal trial. On a freed Johannes Merzely Facebook page, his supporters continue to speak out. That includes his father, who in a post offered a glimpse of what his son's release would be like. Todd Merzely wrote, Johannes is in very good spirits and is looking forward to summer and freedom. The case has already caused so many protests, this could still bring more when Merzely is released. and so forth. And that's, if you want to go to that, you can find that. It's East Bay News. Marzulli could be released from jail by mid-June. Continuing, however, with this much earlier report, interview with two members of the Citizens Police Review Board of Santa Cruz, the board that was killed, Mark Half Moon and Holly Hammond.
Down after they were started hitting him.
You shouldn't flop around when you're being hit.
Right.
The board, I think, I believe, to get back to something mm-hmm. you said earlier, mm-hmm. I believe over the last year we have slowly but steadily been increasing in our effectiveness and becoming more effective, doing more research, looking for a better method of citizen oversight of the police. And as we got closer and closer to that goal and more effective, and having people who just a year ago were criticizing our board for being weak coming to our defense, and to me says something that we impressed those people.
I did feel that there was a momentum building in the CPRB at that point. What I want to ask you is, that does imply that perhaps this sudden axing of the board and there's a very verifiable budget crisis.
Oh, yes.
But there's just something not right about it. Let's talk about the money, okay? The Citizens Police Review Board has a budget of $83,000 a year.
That was the last budget, yes.
Although Dick Wilson, the city manager, has said that the real costs were $112,000 because he can throw in another $30,000 in expenses the police department had to do because of this pesky CPRB board here. But let's just say $83,000. Now, they want to set it up with an auditor model, hiring an attorney. Last time I heard, attorneys make, what, $300 an hour or something
plus,
like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they usually bill for their travel expenses, and this attorney lives in Palo Alto.
It just doesn't seem that there's going to be that great a cost savings. In fact, when everything's all and done, it might actually be more expensive to replace seven all-volunteer people with one high-paid attorney. What do you think about this, the issue about the money?
And the cost issue aside, there is a Citizens Police Review auditor that nobody actually hears about, except people get into a very specialized area. His name is Bob Aronson. He was actually originally the independent lawyer who was hired because the CPRB asked for an opinion that wasn't from City Attorney John Barisoni, because Barisoni also defended the police department and therefore had a conflict of interest. But Aronson took over the money and the job of the entire board, and no one's really heard much from him since. He gives a yearly audio report to the board. He makes no written to the city council, I should say. He makes no written report, and he's... I never heard of anybody having actual conversations with him. So he doesn't act as any kind of an auditor or board substitute at all that I know about.
I'm not happy. Well, I understand they had to do something, but they were so happy to cut us first. And I want to know now, how will we know about how the money's being spent? I mean, how is the city council going to explain to the public about the cases they've reviewed and the way they've spent their new money, right? The new on the auditor. So they haven't discussed that at all.
Yeah, I happen to know some ex city council members, and they are when the city council. I had to laugh when I spoke with Councilmember Kennedy on KUSP the other day when he said the city council would handle these things. We put so many hours into it, and some former council members have told me that it's an overwhelming job being a city council member. Uh-huh. You're always busy. Where are you going to find the time to read those thick files
now,
as part
so
of your
how
job?
How many hours were the two of you putting in a week, Hillary?
Not that much, because I had a full-time job, so I couldn't get down to the...
So for a typical complaint, how many hours would you have to spend for one complaint?
I would spend a minimum of an hour looking through something, and then the time that at the meetings and then discussing it with the rest of the board members. So each complaint.
Or maybe 3 hours?
Maybe 3 hours, and that's, you know, I know that I didn't spend that as much time as I wanted to.
And Mark, you spent a lot more hours.
As chair of the board, I felt it incumbent upon myself to spend to go over the details of each case. Mm-hmm. And I would say the minimum amount of time I spent on any one case would be about 5 hours.
Yeah, one of the claims of the city council currently is that their public safety committee is taking the place of a police review board, that and the Citizens Police Review Auditor, Bob Aronson. But this subcommittee, I'm not aware that it reviews any kind of IA files at all. And, of course, they were completely in the dark and actually rubber stamping police misconduct in 2005 when the police department did its illegal surveillance of the do-it-yourself New Year's activities that was exposed by an out-of-town ACLU, not our local ACLU. And it was such a shameful exposition of how collusive the mayor and the city manager were with the police chief in covering up political surveillance in Santa Cruz.
In fact, it was usually annoying to the staff people. I was always there, always looking through cases.
Okay, so you really have a lot of doubts that the council is just going to take this on and add it on to the, all their other additional duties.
They're not going to do it.
They're not.
And
yeah,
I want to say also that Dick Wilson is hallucinating. And I wouldn't mind having a bit of whatever it is he's taking that makes him see more numbers than are there. Because our
Dick Wilson was the prior city manager, of course, is the real power head and power figure in the city. Now that position is held by Martin Bernal.
They're going to play with the numbers and claim that the overhead expenses and all these other costs come into play, like postage, the use of the office, which the city owns,
and
the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women still occupies the office.
Mm-hmm.
The staff time, we had two part-time staff people, and they are making a claim that they had to pay $20,000 to $30,000 in police overtime to have the police liaison there. Well, when I got on the board, I found the police liaison was sitting in on our closed sessions where we're deliberating cases between the police and a complainant. And there was no representative of the complainant there, but we had a representative of the police department who was always explaining and justifying the acts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quickly moved to have this, we had a vote and had this person removed from our closed sessions.
I think maybe that was the beginning of the end of the CPRB when you did that.
Yeah, I think
you can't have those citizens thinking for themselves without a police officer telling them what they're supposed to think.
Since she is no longer, that sergeant is no longer at the closed sessions, that's a cut in overtime hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that I don't think that the police representative was very helpful to our meetings in general. I felt that often there was a hostility that you could almost feel toward people who came up to the mic to speak with us, and I believe that we as a board should treat the public with respect.
But that we pay so much for the PR from the police.
Right, right.
What was that?
And to talk about the money, too, I wanted to mention, I know it's a budget crisis, but in looking at the police budget, I saw in the budget back in June that there was $114,000 for vehicle abatement.
Mm-hmm.
And I know abandoned vehicles could probably be a really large problem to some people, but the mayor said we have to tighten our belts.
Mm-hmm.
How is that really a public safety issue?
It seems you could cut $20,000-$30,000 out of that.
And the other one is the $980,000 that the police department has for a community relations budget.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is that's over 10 times what the CPRB got.
Well, you know, the Santa Cruz Police Department budget is the largest budget item in the general fund. It's 33% of the general fund for the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Now, Sandy Brown, who's a former CPRB member, I heard her on KSCO today, and she said why we could take a tenth of that money from the Santa Cruz Police Department, their PR budget, and fund the CPRB with that. And she thought that was reasonable. She didn't see we had to cut Harvey West Pool
or
a child care center or anything important, you know, or the homeless services, which probably have already undercut, had a lot of cuts
Well, I think
so
that's true.
You two are in favor of that idea of funding the CPRB from the Santa Cruz Police Department PR budget?
Oh, yes. I mean, what PR do they... they have a picnic in Beach Flats every year
and
or something?
The Citizen Police Academy, which is a 12-week course where they... It's basically a public relations thing.
Yeah.
But the question is, isn't oversight of the police in a police department that claims to have community policing, isn't oversight of the police part of that? And if this is community relations, why doesn't the money, why doesn't the city council take that money from the police and give it to us?
I have one more quick question. Is there a CPRB in exile? Inquiring minds want to know.
Well, I would like to see a CPRB in exile. I consider myself still the chair of the CPRB in exile because...
And if people wanted to contact you, how would they get a hold of you?
They would get a hold of me at markhalfmoon@yahoo.com. Or call my voicemail, which is 831-457-9754, extension 1788.
That's great. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm all for the CPRB in exile because as a homeless advocate, I know that we do have a problem with police harassment, selective enforcement, and police misconduct. We still have that problem. I don't have confidence in the auditor model, and I think the citizens really need to stay in there. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And thanks, Hillary.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
And that was a audio portion of a video of the Club Cruise show by Becky Johnson from about 9 years ago, well, 8 years ago in 2003, 7 years ago in 2003, on the demise of the Police Review Board with Citizens Police Review Board Chair Mark Halfmoon and I guess Police Board CPRB member, Citizens Police Review Board member Holly Hammond. I just don't remember her very well. Nor do I remember her name, and I'm still trying to get this Hillary Ham. Well, I had the H right. That's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And we have the Police Love-In Society has just joined us here. Uncle Dennis is here to play some pro-police tunes from the 60s and 70s, perhaps. He's looking up I Really Love the Cops on YouTube, and I'm not quite sure whether this tends to celebrate the Santa Cruz police, the deputies, or just police in general. You'll be able to learn more about this.
It's not here anymore.
Oh, dear. Oh, well. From the cream to the dregs is coming up. It's going to be, I guess, less talk and more music. But, you know, those of you who are willing to accept that kind of treatment from Uncle Dennis, well, I guess you deserve it. What can I say? I'll be back on Sunday, I guess, Sunday morning at 9:30. Perhaps Thomas Levitt will be doing the wake-up call. I've just gotten an email from him that he has not been aware that we've been on the air for the last week and a half, and he apparently is eager.
That's because he doesn't get email.
Well, Thomas is a busy man, and he's better a busy man than a busy body, as we say, and he'll be coming back hopefully to do his 7:30 to 9:30 cream to the dregs. No, that's you. Wake-up call. That's it, the wake-up call show. So check him out then. If you want to do some work on circulating this petition to settle the lawsuit and end the sleeping ban, you have to get past Uncle Dennis. But if you can do that, give me
We need to spend money on court cases and not kids.
There you go. See, and there's a guy who's actually got a certain legal sense to him. I mean, you would do well in John Barisoni's office, I think. I mean, you may have a second career mapped out for yourself there, Uncle Dennis. Give me a call on the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Huff is, of course, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And I will return your call, and you can... We can take it from there. Thanks again for hanging in there for this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Thanks to Becky Johnson for doing that show. And thanks to Uncle Dennis for apparently trying to find something about the police department that has eluded him.
Well, it's a song that I heard years ago, and I thought there was a copy of it on YouTube, but it's a very satirical song called I Really Love the Cops. And... I can't seem to find it anymore. Anyway, here's some King Crimson for you.